From the Mound Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. I'm A. Martinez. The Dodgers bring a crown home to Los Angeles. Second time this month that has happened. You can thank the Lakers for that. But the night fell just short of perfection, and you can blame coronavirus for that. We'll break down the highs and lows of World Series baseball under the shadow of a pandemic. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm A. Martinez. Coming up.
The drive is to ensure that the individuals that are experiencing homelessness has an opportunity to vote.
There's a major push to make sure the unhoused population in Los Angeles gets a chance to exercise their civic duty. We'll tell you what's going on with that in about 20 minutes. But we start with LA's big win last night.
I was just ready to run down the street and, like, faint or something.
Oh, my gosh. It feels so great. I can't believe it. We've all waited so long. It's been so much heartache. The city suffered so much. And for them to do it this year, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, Dodger fans overjoyed. That's a daughter and father duo, Margo and RJ Robinson, celebrating in Burbank last night, along with a couple of dogs. But things downtown did get a little ugly as revelry turned into something more resembling rioting. The Los Angeles Police Department declared unlawful assemblies in downtown and Echo Park, and at least 8 arrests were made. And then today, this. LA County officials are holding a COVID-19 briefing to discuss how fan gatherings and celebrations after the Lakers and Dodgers championships may be adding to a spike in coronavirus cases. I mean, geez, 2020, you can't even let us have this. Yeah, well, that kind of thing does cast a shadow on the Dodgers' first World Series win in 32 years, but then so does a positive coronavirus test for one of its star players, third baseman Justin Turner. Major League Baseball announced earlier today that it will be investigating Turner's actions on the field last night. So, to talk about the highs and lows of this championship run, we welcome back Molly Knight, senior staff writer and columnist for The Athletic LA and author of the book The Best Team Money Can Buy. And we also have with us Hockey Hall of Fame writer and LA Times columnist Helene Elliott. Welcome, Molly. Welcome, Helene.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right. First off, when the last out happened and the celebrations began, what was the first thought that crossed your mind? Molly, start us off.
I really couldn't believe it. I mean, this team has been very good for so long, but for whatever reason, this championship has eluded them. And I know, we've talked about it a lot in the past. It felt surreal in that moment. It was a crazy game, and the way that the final out was recorded with just a strikeout looking like it was the easiest thing ever. I was just scratching my head.
Yeah, there was a smoothness to it at the end there. Helene, what about you? What did you think when the Dodgers clinched?
I thought that Major League Baseball got very lucky that this didn't have to go to a seventh game, because by then the news of Justin Turner's positive test had come out. And my immediate thought was, oh, my goodness, if they had to go to a seventh game, what would they have done? Because people would have had to be quarantined, tested, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. And a game seven, I mean, the crown jewel of your sports season might have been delayed for who knows how long.
We'll get into more into Justin Turner in just a bit. Molly, I mentioned your book, The Best Team Money Can Buy, which is all about the Guggenheim Group buying the team from Frank McCourt and then hiring Andrew Friedman from the Rays to run the baseball operations. How can we see what you wrote about in the book blossom into what happened this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the best and worst things about baseball is that the champion is sort of a little bit random each year. I mean, they're, you know, always a good team, but you just never know. I mean, last year, the Washington Nationals played terrible baseball for the first 60 games. And then by the end, they were the best team. So really, it's just a question of getting into the playoffs, and then it kind of becomes a crapshoot. So it's just every year going back to the drawing board and trying to figure out how to add those pieces and then hoping and praying that you get hot at the right moment. It's just the best thing about the game and the most heartbreaking heartbreaking thing about the game, and that point still stands.
Helene, your colleague at the LA Times, Bill Plaschke, who's always very calm and rational about stuff, he makes the case today that this title might be the sweetest one of the six that the Dodgers have won here in Los Angeles. Considering what 2020 has been like, how do you think that stacks up?
I think Bill makes a very good point for a number of reasons. I mean, number one, what players went through in order for this season to even happen. I mean, constant testing, protocols, being away from their families for most of the playoffs. And it was just such a refreshing sight to see Clayton Kershaw happy at the end of a season instead of sitting slumped and looking at another team celebrating. I mean, just for that alone, I think you have to have a spot in your heart, no matter who you root for. I mean, this guy is just a thoroughly class act. He's a future Hall of Fame pitcher. I think anybody who follows baseball and values what he does had to be happy for him.
Speaking of Clayton Kershaw, because before the series began, I had a tough time trying to rank which Dodger had more on the line, either Clayton Kershaw or manager Dave Roberts. I mean, either way, they both got redemption. But Molly, who do you think had more to lose if things did not go well in 2020?
Probably Dave Roberts, because they're not going to fire Clayton Kershaw from a job status standpoint. But, you know, the thing about Clayton, and Helene just hit it right on the head. This is a guy who is just a world-class human being, and anybody who watches baseball understands that and can feel, at least, you know, even if they don't like the Dodgers, they can feel warm feelings about this really good human winning after so many years of playoff failure and playoff just hard luck and just being asked to do everything to carry that team. It's just, and unfortunately, even though he's a Hall of Fame pitcher and the best of his generation, that pall would have hung over his career because they got so close so many times and didn't make it. So it's just a relief, I think, for all of us who cover the Dodgers too, or cover the LA sports, to not have to write the same story over and over again, to finally have something new to write about.
Helene, Molly mentions how Clayton Kershaw is a Hall of Famer. He absolutely is. If he retired today, 5 years from now, he would be inducted into baseball's Hall of Fame. But, you know, going into this series, there was a lot hanging on him when it comes to his postseason success or failure. How much do you think Clayton Kershaw gets maybe a stamp of approval somehow by this World Series win?
Well, I think it's less a stamp of approval than kind of a shedding the label of this kind of almost tragic figure. You know, this honorable guy who seemed to do everything right, you know, class guy off the field, very involved in charitable initiatives with his wife and his family. But for all the individual achievements, he could never enjoy that one team achievement. So I think it's kind of recasts his, I don't want to say legacy because that's different, but I think it recasts his image a little bit, that now he's not, there's no more sadness or nothing missing from his resume anymore.
I've always thought that now, for any fan that says, well, he's not Koufax, well, now he is, because he's both a Cy Young winner and a World Series champion. So that conversation or that argument's out the window. We're talking to Molly Knight, senior staff writer and columnist for The Athletic LA, and Hockey Hall of Fame writer and LA Times columnist Helene Elliott. Now, last night in the ballpark in Arlington, the roof was closed. Toward the end of the game, the Dodgers had a little bit of an issue with third baseman Justin Turner. That wound up being a big blue elephant in the biggest room possible. Helene, so take us through what we know about what happened last night with Justin Turner.
Well, thanks to the hard work done by my colleague, Bill Shaken, what he was able to find out is that, and I think it's fairly well known now, that Turner had a test that was inconclusive. The results were inconclusive on Monday. He was retested on Tuesday, and because it was one test rather than 30 or 40 tests for the entire traveling party, the results were turned around very quickly. The results came back positive. Major League Baseball communicated that to the Dodgers. That was also communicated, obviously, to manager Dave Roberts. And Turner was pulled before the top of the eighth inning, And it was interesting because on TV they were speculating, was he injured? Nobody quite knew. There was no announcement. And then it became public knowledge that he had had a positive test.
And then the other part of this, too, is that Justin Turner came back out on the field to celebrate with his teammates. And actually, we're hearing that Major League Baseball advised him not to. He said, I'm going. His teammates wanted him to be there as well. And reaction has been split. Some are calling him selfish to put all the people that were out on the field celebrating in danger of getting infected. And others say that, you know, it's a guy that's been working for this most of his life for this exact moment. So let him have it. Molly, where do you come down on this?
I mean, I thought it was absolutely insane and irresponsible. I did not understand why it was happening. I mean, we know he's positive. This is national television, and he's out there, you know, hugging teammates and without his mask on at certain points. And it was just, it was such a poor decision. I mean, so many of us in the last year have sacrificed and gone through things. Like people have postponed their weddings, people have missed their graduations, people, you know, their first day of kindergarten. You know, I had a family member die in June, and only two of us could be in the room. I mean, just horrible, horrible things. And so we all understand, all of us have been affected by this. And I did not see it as a life or death situation to be out there. And you know, he's going to pay for that, and he should.
Helene, what do you think, or where do you come down on this?
Yeah, I wrote a column that was posted on the LATimes.com website this morning saying that it was irresponsible. I've been engaging with readers today, and people are saying, well, you know, he's been around his teammates all this time and none of them has gotten sick. Well, this time he was in very close proximity with Dave Roberts, neither of them wearing masks. Roberts has a history of cancer. You know, other people have said, well, he's on the field with a lot of young, healthy athletes. It'll be fine. Well, not everybody was a young, healthy athlete. There were players' families, wives, kids, parents, and certainly some of those people fell into a higher risk demographic for getting COVID. So, you know, he took a very big chance. I understand the emotion carried him, but I still think it was irresponsible for him to be out there without a mask.
Who bears the biggest responsibility here? Is it Turner, who reportedly insisted on coming out of the field, his Dodger teammates who wanted him out there, or Major League Baseball, maybe for not saying to Turner, no, you absolutely cannot do this, Molly?
You know, obviously, Justin Turner made a decision. He's a grown man, and he'll be held accountable for that decision. But at the same time, MLB invited 11,000 fans to come to these games. I don't know where they can, how they can say that they created some kind of a bubble. I mean, they made an economic decision to have the game in Texas at the new Rangers ballpark because, you know, those owners were obviously, you know, crushed that they couldn't welcome fans this year. And I thought that was a bad decision to begin with. And it gives them not very much standing to criticize Turner because they put economics over health and safety in that decision.
All right. Now, we won't end this on such a bummer kind of note because over the decades, the Dodgers and Lakers in a lot of ways have jostled for the honor of the title of the team that owns L.A., although for most Angelinos, they're probably 1 and 1A, and you can take your pick on who holds the top spot. But this weird year has made them both champions, and the last and only other time that has happened was 1988. So what do you two think of this dual championship by the Dodgers and Lakers and what it means for the city of Los Angeles? Helene, let's start with you.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, if they had both been here and won the championship, I think there would have been a stronger emotional connection. I wonder if everybody watching at a distance and not being able to even be around Staples Center while the Lakers were playing, you know, not having the games on a big screen outside the arena, I wonder if that made it a little distant. Plus, I think people are worried about so many other things now, you know, their jobs, their health. When is this going to end? When is life going to get back to normal? So I wonder if the joy is muted a little bit, or maybe you could argue, too, that the joy is enhanced by the fact of here's something good that came out of this. Here's something we can all get behind and be happy for. And heaven knows we haven't had a lot to be happy about lately.
Molly, what about you? What does this dual championship year mean for L.A.?
Yeah, I do think it's a little bit of a 1A town with the Lakers having the edge just because they're such a global brand. But Last night, I mean, there were, I heard more fireworks last night than I did when the Lakers won. And obviously this town is thrilled to be able to celebrate both of those championships. But there's something about how the Dodgers just kept losing year after year that made this feel like, oh my gosh, like just relief on top of joy. The Lakers are pretty good at winning, and they won 10 years ago. So it seemed like LA was even more excited for the Dodger win last night than they were for the Lakers.
That's Molly Knight, senior staff writer and columnist for The Athletic LA and author of The Best Team Money Can Buy and Hockey Hall of Fame writer and LA Times columnist Helene Elliott. Helene, Molly, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, now to the election. The big day is next Tuesday, but already we've seen an overwhelming turnout for early voting this month. Close to 2 million people have voted in LA County so far, and many more in surrounding counties. So we've been asking Southern California voters, many who are doing it for the first time and those who've never missed an election, why they vote. Here's Vanessa Gill, age 24.
Voting is a duty that we have as U.S. citizens. It's one of the main, absolute major ways for us to have our voices heard and have an actual impact in our communities, both local and statewide, regional, and nationally. It's the way for us to continue having a sort of social impact on things that are beyond just us in our day-to-day lives.
That's voter Vanessa Gill. We'll be hearing more of the voices throughout the show and in the coming days. Yeah, so you heard about how this year there's been a huge surge in early voting. Lots of reasons why, but outreach and information, pretty high on the list. And those two factors are exactly the reason why one specific group of voters have been able to cast their ballots despite some not even having an address. That story's coming up next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. In any election year, voting if you're homeless is no easy task. I mean, just getting to a polling station could be a whole ordeal, let alone having an address to register to vote. But this year, with the coronavirus pandemic hitting unhoused individuals in shelters especially hard, those challenges have only been exacerbated. For more on what folks are facing this year, we have Jessica Brown Mason with us. She is a social service worker at the Homeless Outreach Program Integrated Care System in Los Angeles. Jessica, so right now you're calling us from one of your organization's housing sites that also happens to be an early voting site. How's it going so far?
It is going well. We were able to set up very early in the morning, and we have, at this particular site, housed 100 individuals, and the clients are coming in. And as well, there is a couple of encampments in the local area where we reached out to in order to provide voting services. So we have community members as well as those that are housed in our program.
What about voting? Have you seen lots of people come in to take advantage of the early voting site?
Yes, we have our clients that are in the program that are voting. So we have some really good participation thus far. And we're doing outreach. We'll do another push on the outreach this afternoon, encouraging people to come in and making sure that they understand that they can register and vote at the same time.
Jessica, can you give us a sense of what kind of turnout we typically see from the unhoused population and what's being done differently this year to make sure that their vote counts and is happening?
There's a very low percentage because, again, there's a perception in the community that if you don't have an address, you couldn't vote. A stationary address, you couldn't vote. If you were homeless, you couldn't vote. So we have done quite a bit of work on social media. We have a huge outreach team that goes into encampments And we had our team working very hard and diligently to get the word out to people who were living in encampments and making sure that they were aware that we have three sites that HOPIX is sponsoring for families and individuals that we're servicing to come in, as well as outreaching to the broader community. But specifically for the clients that we serve, having that opportunity. One of the key parts that we're playing is making sure that those individuals who are experiencing any type of disabilities in wheelchairs or walkers or anything like that, we're making special accommodations. We're transporting clients from the encampments to the voting site if they so desire. So we're doing as much as we can and trying to meet every need so that if someone is saying, I would like to vote, then we'll make every effort to get them to the polls.
Wondering, Jessica, when you guys do your outreach with people who are unhoused and you're talking to them about voting, is it generally a sense that, hey, that they weren't aware that they could vote?
Yeah, that would be the general perception.
And what do you got to do to convince them or make them believe or understand that, yes, you can vote. You are a citizen. You can vote. You have every right to do this.
Well, one is relational. So our outreach team members are visiting, you know, frequently the areas. They get to know the clients. The clients build a trusting relationship with them. And so being able to educate them on their ability to vote, their right to vote, giving them the opportunity to come into the office, to register, to work with them on the streets, providing the transportation so that they're able to come in and feel comfortable with that process.
What kind of response do you get when they realize that they can vote? Are they excited? Do they get pumped up to be part of the process that maybe they thought they couldn't be part of?
Yeah, it was really interesting this morning when I was setting up. One of the clients approached me and she was just really excited. She was like, I really am so happy that we have this opportunity to vote. I want to vote on issues that are relevant to homelessness and substance use disorders. So she was like ready to vote for these measures and for the elected officials that would make a difference in her life experiences and making sure that those people who followed her would have the same opportunity and would be able to receive services because of the vote that she's cast.
You know, Jessica, we've seen an overwhelming response so far among voters everywhere. But what's driving this effort to reach the homeless? Because it sounds like there's a lot more intention behind it this year.
The drive is to ensure that those people are the individuals that are experiencing homelessness has an opportunity to vote, knowing that they may not have that opportunity, right? Or may not have the knowledge of having those opportunities. So the drive is to bring the polls to the people in the areas where they are. So they may have transportation issues. They're living in encampments, you know, just various disabilities may be preventing them from getting to the polls in a comfortable setting. Or an early voting is making a difference, right? Because people know now we have time to vote. They don't have to necessarily stand in line. It's a place where it's convenient. These individuals are just like all the rest of us. They want to make sure that their voices are heard. And so we're pushing it out and making sure that we get the word out.
That's Jessica Brown Mason, social service worker at the Homeless Outreach Program Integrated Care System in Los Angeles. Jessica, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, staying with the election, we've been hearing from Southern California voters today, and already we've seen an overwhelming turnout this month from mail-in ballots to in-person voting. Close to 2 million people have voted in L.A. County so far, so we've been asking people why they vote. Well, here's Jake Henry, age 23.
Voting gave people who are designed to not have access and a say-so in our country more power, and if you don't vote, someone you don't agree with will vote, and their vote will matter more. So get out there and vote. Don't let someone's vote that you disagree with matter more. Make your voice heard, because a decision will be made regardless.
That is voter Jake Henry. All right, moving on. The incoming California State University chancellor will be the first Mexican-American to lead the 23-campus system. His ethnic and class backgrounds are resonating in different ways throughout CSU campuses. KPCC's Adolfo Guzman Lopez reports.
Last month, Cal State's trustees appointed Joseph Castro the new chancellor of the nearly 500,000-student university system.
I'm excited and honored to be the first California native and first Mexican American to serve as the chancellor of the California State University.
He made a clear distinction in his acceptance speech. While Castro has on occasion described himself as Latino, he said in an interview with KPCC that he specified Mexican American because it embodied his heritage as a son of the San Joaquin Valley.
I wanted to describe my background in a way that would resonate with the people of California and the country.
His grandparents and great-grandparents emigrated to Central California from Mexico. The first generation helped build the railroads. The second were farm workers. He was raised by a single mother who was a beautician.
Myself, as a first-gen Mexicana, Chicana faculty member, I felt absolutely seen by that.
That's Cal State Dominguez Hills professor Yesenia Fernandez. She liked Castro's use of Mexican-American because for her, it reflects a connection to Mexico's indigenous population and the land.
He chose specifically to center the people and center the people's journey and his people's journey, his ancestral journey. That's what was really powerful.
In a time when Latino, Latinx, and Hispanic are used as catch-all labels, Castro says his use of the term Mexican-American helps to place focus on how specific ethnic identities inform different experiences.
I never felt like I had to hide it, that's for sure. There was a lot of pride in my hometown of Hanford and a realization that there were immigrants from many different places.
Like the working-class experiences shared by the Central Valley's Punjabi, Armenian, and Hmong farmworker families. Castro's chosen label is informed by his upbringing and professional life there, says California politics researcher David Ayon.
The university that he leaves behind, Fresno State, the student body is majority Latino. And the university that he helped set up, UC Merced, it's just barely, but also majority Latino. But the overwhelming majority of that majority, I mean like overwhelming, almost entirely, is of Mexican origin, Mexican American.
About 40% of Californians are Latino or Hispanic, the census's term. But in the largest Central Valley counties, they make up more than half the population. What is the Central Valley experience? There are many. Sarah Borjas captures one in her poem, What I Know About Fresno.
I reach out my car's window, and grapevines disappear underneath my arm like beautiful sea creatures. Or my mother and her sisters scuttling underneath the Chevy's shade while my grandma picks cotton the entire day.
Borjas graduated from Fresno State.
It's like not a choice, you know? The fact that we have like a large family or that we're dedicated, that we're devoted, that we're loyal. Sometimes they're like the only things that we have to hold us up.
For the first time in the state's history, the Cal State Chancellor, Community Colleges Chancellor, University of California President, and State Superintendent of Schools will be Black or Latino or both. That's important for all Californians, said UC Merced Professor Daisy Reyes.
It doesn't matter just for Latinx students, but it also matters for non-Latinx students, right? To show that Latinx people belong everywhere and should have a seat at all tables.
However, she said, an ethnic or racial label can only take them so far.
People are going to be looking at see what this looks like in practice. What does this actually mean in your agenda?
Higher education in California is in a tough spot. Budget cuts that are likely to grow next year, and a pandemic that's testing whether the institutions can adequately educate their students. And while these leaders can connect to students who may often feel unseen, their legacies are more likely to be shaped by how they respond to these challenges. Covering higher education, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez.
Three years after the Me Too movement, and sexual harassment is still a problem in the entertainment biz, Anita Hill leads the Hollywood Commission, which was tasked with finding out how much of a problem it still is. And the nearly 10,000 people surveyed say, yeah, sexual harassment persists, and male victims often feel left out of the conversation. We'll hear from Anita Hill when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. You can also get this show as a podcast on the KPCC app. I'm Amy Martinez. It's time for a weekly look at news from the entertainment biz in our segment, On the Lot.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
And today, pinch hitting for Rebecca Keegan is KPCC's own John Horn. And he's bringing us news from the latest Me Too investigation into Hollywood. This one isn't about a particular person's bad behavior. Instead, it looks at the industry as a whole. All right, John, this investigation has been led by Anita Hill. She was famously the law professor who testified during the Supreme Court hearings for Clarence Thomas back in 91. And she recounted experiences of having been sexually harassed by him when they were colleagues. So, John, how did Anita Hill end up leading this Hollywood commission?
Well, it feels like she was in many ways the right person, because not only was she allegedly sexually harassed, she was not believed. And that's another part of what she found during this investigation. So she was asked by some big names here in Hollywood, including Kathy Kennedy, who's the president of Lucasfilm, and Nina Shaw, who's a very prominent attorney. Hill was contacted about 3 years ago, but let's remember what happened just before that. It was actually 3 years ago this month that the New York Times and the New Yorker published their bombshell stories about Harvey Weinstein and his long history of sexual assaults. In March earlier this year, Weinstein was sentenced to 23 years for rape and sexual assault, and he faces more charges in L.A. But his case led to many other powerful men in Hollywood and the media being called out as sexual predators: NBC's Matt Lauer, CBS's Les Moonves, Kevin Spacey. The list is long. So this is what Anita Hill told me yesterday about why she wanted to take on this job.
Well, it was exactly about 3 years ago when I was approached. And of course, the entertainment industry was at the center of the Me Too scandal. And so I not only looked at the fact that they were at the center of the scandal, but also in a position to influence the way people think about the issue, think about the roles of women more generally, but specifically about ways that women are portrayed that undermine our ability to fight the problem of sexual violence and harassment and bias in many forms.
And John, there it sounds like she's talking about the power of what Hollywood puts on the screen and how that can influence behavior in our wider culture.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think that's why, you know, the images we see are really important, not only in terms of the stories that are told, but also in the people who get to tell those stories. I mean, pop culture is hugely influential, and movies and TV shows, pop music, you name it, can really influence the way that we see the world. And if Hollywood is being run by a group of people, mostly men, who tend to have not very forward-thinking views about women and may even mistreat them, a little bit is that going to creep into how women are depicted on screen, whether or not they're going to be, you know, random victims of sexual harassment, the way their bodies might be sexualized. So it's not only important what happens in the, you know, in the day-to-day offices and on sets, but also about the images that Hollywood projects. And while that was a lesser part of the study, it's why it's important that Hollywood's house is in order so that it's making content that is relevant and well-suited to what's going on in the world.
So, John, who was on this Hollywood commission with Anita Hill, and what was the goal?
Well, the real goal was to try to figure out what has changed and what hasn't. So it was, you know, it was Anita Hill, it was Kathy Kennedy, it was this lawyer, Nina Shaw, and a lot of staff, because they went out and they got responses from almost 10,000 people. And those people were people who either have worked, were working, or prospectively working in the entertainment business. And this is their mission statement. I mean, it's pretty lofty, but this is what they were trying to do. And it says, "We will lead the entertainment industry to a strong and equitable future by defining and implementing best practices that eliminate sexual harassment and bias for all workers, especially marginalized communities, and actively promote a culture of accountability, respect, and equality."
Now, these anonymous surveys, John, were they public? Have you got a chance to look at them, read them?
Yeah, I have. And I mean, they're public in that you can look at them. You can go to hollywoodcommission.org and look at some of the reports. But what is really heartbreaking is the repeated stories that all echo one another. I'm just going to read one, an excerpt from one. And this is a woman who says, I've worked in the industry for 20 years. I've been sexually assaulted and subjected to unwanted touching more times than I can count. Oof. I have reported through supposedly confidential processes and then been the victim of retaliation. I have no confidence that the situation is improving despite the public statements by industry leaders professing to want to make change. And there's so many other people who said almost the same thing.
And that explains why people stay silent. You know, they've issued 5 reports, John. What are some of the key findings that you've released?
I guess as that one person says that, you know, nothing really has changed. And I think it's important that there's certain kinds of behaviors that are worth noting. You know, one is pretty obvious. That's sexual assault. Sexual harassment is sometimes a little harder to define. And then there's like there's gender bias. Do you treat a woman differently than you treat a man? There are unwelcome sexual attention. There's a lot of things that goes into that. But what really stood out to me is that more than half of the women who responded, age 24 to 39, said they had been subject to unwanted sexual attention. More than half. 1 out of 2. And that falls short of harassment, but I think it's systemic. And it is in many ways kind of the entry for a lot of men. If they can get away with unwanted sexual attention, who knows what's going to follow. So here's what Anita Hill said about those numbers.
Anytime that you have 1 in 5 women or 1 in 10 men saying that in the course of their career, they have been a victim of sexual assault in their workplace, you have a problem that you cannot ignore. And if we want to be a model, if we want to be an influencer, we need to deal with these issues head on and really dig in once again and do even harder work to get there.
John, what kind of hard work is Anita Hill saying needs to be done?
Well, I mean, I think you and I probably went through recent sexual harassment training. It's part of what KPCC does regularly. But the training doesn't mean anything. And I think you probably remember there are all these scenarios that were given. And it's like, what do you do? And almost always the case is report to HR. Now, reporting to HR in Hollywood doesn't always work. There's a famous story about somebody reporting Harvey Weinstein's behavior to the Weinstein Company's HR department. They forwarded her complaint back to Harvey. So unless you have accountability without retaliation, you're really going to get stuck. And the other thing that's also really important is you have to define what is unacceptable. Because once you start doing something that is wrong, you start doing other things that are even more wrong. And then it grows and feeds on itself. So you really have to kind of nip things in the bud. So this is what Anita Hill said about her experience about people who don't take something like gender harassment seriously.
It's often accepted as something that's just par for the course, part of the job, you know, toughen up and stick with it. And so you may not even go to an HR person, or if you do go to an HR person or a manager, the manager may just say, you know, that's just the way things are. But the important thing for us to know about gender harassment is that it is a gateway behavior to much more serious forms of harassment. And we believe that if we can get people to pay attention to some of the things that they are not taking seriously, like gender harassment and like bullying, that we will be able to avoid some of the high numbers that we find for unwanted sexual attention and coercion and then assault.
So, John, it seems like Anita Hill is saying that if we take bullying and gender harassment seriously, then that could finally lead to stopping other harassment and even worse things. I mean, you've covered this business a long time, John. Does that resonate?
It totally resonates. I mean, there's a story that sticks with me, and that is that Morgan Freeman, when he was running his production company, might still have it, he would line up his assistants and staff, many of whom were women, and he'd walk around them in very close proximity as if he was inspecting a car, like looking at these people as if they were objects. And nobody said, Morgan, you can't do that. What are you doing? And I think what Anita Hill is getting at is that you have to stop that kind of behavior in its tracks, because if somebody like Morgan Freeman gets away with that, then what does he do next? And people obviously are afraid of power imbalances. They're afraid of retaliation. They're afraid of what will happen to their careers if they don't play along. And I think Hollywood has taken advantage of that for far too long. And that's part of what Anita and the commission are trying to get at.
That's KPCC's John Horn, host of the podcast Hollywood the Sequel, which you can hear on Apple Podcasts. John, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, more Take Two coming up in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org. I'm E. Martinez. In the spirit of Halloween, we're looking into what makes a story scary. Yeah, we know jump scares and spooky imagery can cause fear, but what happens when you get rid of the visual aspect and can only use sound to tell a scary story? Yeah, we're talking about podcasts, and this week, Nick Kwa, host of the LA Studios podcast Servant of Pod, talks about just that, laying the creep down. All right, Nick, so this week, you split your episode in two halves to create one big Halloween special. Let's start with the first part. You spoke with Jeffrey Craner, co-creator of Welcome to Night Vale and co-writer on Within the Wires. Tell us about these podcasts.
Welcome to Night Vale, really popular fiction podcast started by Jeffrey and his creative partner, Joseph Fink, in 2014. And these days, it's kind of the patron saint of fiction podcasts in general. The premise of the show is that basically follows the broadcast of a community radio station in a town where spooky, weird things happen all the time. And it typically mixes like fun, surreal humor with a ton of horror imagery. It's great stuff. Night Vale has become prominent enough that it's given like Fink and Craner the latitude to create a bunch of other shows. Joseph made one called Alice Isn't Dead a few years ago, which is a serialized fiction show. And Jeffrey, who I spoke to for this episode, made an anthology podcast called Within the Wires, which deals in a kind of like creepy Lynchian story that leans really hard into sort of like the structural premise of the format. The narrative often takes the form of recorded cassette tapes, and you know, it's like a narrator building a world in slow, incremental, often creepy ways.
Now, okay, you mentioned how you spoke with Jeffrey, and actually, Nick, you had me at community radio station in a small town where creepy things happen. I mean, that's sold for me. You asked him about what makes a story scary or creepy. What did he tell you?
Yeah, so I should say, like, there's a huge body of discourse and literary criticism specifically about this question, right? Like, about what makes something scary, how do you, you know, create a structure of horror, things like that. But what I wanted to learn specifically when talking to Jeffrey is how he thought about those questions and how he sort of thinks about deploying it in audio work specifically. So he talks about a couple of big ideas, but one that he notions to in particular is just getting at a sense of like a universality of feelings that tend to make people scared. So not just like jump scares and whatever, but like trying to go for something a bit more primal. And for Jeffrey, he talks about two things in particular in this clip.
The stuff that's really effective, I think, really gets to the heart of our lack of security and maybe our extreme guilt for how we feel about ourselves. Hmm. And so, you know, ghosts and monsters and evil forces that can kill or maim or hold us prisoner, those things often are kind of externalizations of the things that we feel inside. So I think tapping into a universality is really important.
I understand what he means because, yeah, those feelings are when you don't feel as good about existing in the world. And if someone can tap into that in some way and you're listening to their product, yeah, I could see how kind of the scariness can come out. Okay, so but in the world of audio, though, how is sound used differently and effectively to make a story scary?
Yeah, so, you know, the way that I understood it, there's some commonality between, like, evoking horror in audio and evoking horror in, like, novels. Because in many ways, you're leaning into the non-visuality of the thing that you're trying to conjure. And so that, in turn, depends a lot on, like, on the one hand, throwing the audience into a sense of unknown and making them, like, kind of do the work of imagining the scary stuff themselves. And Jeffrey talks a little bit about that in this clip, about the nature of just letting them do the work.
I love writing Night Vale and some of the horror elements of Within the Wires too in podcast form, because the podcast doesn't let you see anything. So you can only really give the listener little bits and pieces and make their brains do all the extra work. And that's what's scary. When you turn around and the spider is gone from the ceiling directly above your bed, you're like, oh crap, where did the spider go? And then your mind is racing. Is it in the bed now? Is it on me? Is it in my shoe? And I think with podcasts, you can really do that super well.
He is so right, Nick. There is nothing scarier than what I can imagine for myself. We're talking with Nick Kwa. He's the host of Serving a Pod, a podcast about podcasting. All right, Nick, now that leads us into the second half of the podcast, where you put together a montage of voice memos from several podcast creators explaining how they sound design horror podcasts. So who did you hear from and what did you learn?
So we sent out requests for voice memos from four different shows. One's called Unwell, the other one's called Mabel, and there's a show called Hebrew Monsters, and Archive 81. So I learned a couple of things. There's a couple of common traits in the way these four teams kind of think about creating creepy stuff. There seems to be a general affinity towards creating like tape degradation sounds, like just recording fuzziness to create a sense of disorientation. Another commonality, which I think is actually really interesting, is that with fiction podcasts in general, but horror podcasts specifically, there's like an interesting reliance on, you know, what's called the epistolary form, sort of, you know, grounding the logic of the show in a series of documents. So it's a common trope in fiction horror podcasts where they use kind of like a fictional public radio reporter to serve as the narrator, and the story is being told through like their recordings. Like it's a way to bring logic into the show. And one other idea that I really liked that came across in these voice memos came from Jeff Etman, who makes Here Be Monsters. And he talks about this idea that like there are some sounds that you might not particularly personally think is unsettling, but other people might. And he uses the example of like bird recordings as one that he really loves, but other people find really creepy.
A couple of times when I've put sounds like that into episodes, I've gotten feedback from listeners that this is like a weird sound to be into, because some people, it turns out, find those sounds to be really creepy.
Nick, when making a horror story, how is audio different from something visual like a movie? I mean, what setbacks and advantages exist in this specific medium?
In many ways, audio, and again, I would say written fiction, really draws a sense of collaboration from the audience, in the sense that like, as the person creating the work, you're setting them up to scare themselves. And so it's different from television and film, which can really, you know, just create some really unsettling stuff for your brain just to chew on. But again, in TV and film, I think they also do a sort of variation of this tactic of like, there's this thing that people say about monster movies, that part of what makes a monster scary is that if you don't show too much of it, you parcel it out.
Predator, that's one.
Alien,
yeah. Predator, all of those. And Blair Witch Project, too. I mean, you never really
1,000,000%,
saw.
Yeah.
Now, before we let you go, Nick, Halloween right around the corner. Do you have any spooky recommendations to share for fans of horror who maybe have not yet sampled horror podcasts?
Absolutely. So in addition to all the shows discussed in this episode, Night Vale, Within the Wires, and well, Mabel, Hebrew Monsters, Archive 81, there's a couple of good main scenes out there. There's a show called No Sleep, which is a, you know, kind of a fairly popular creepypasta kind of scary story show. Let me also toss to one kind of not particularly conventional pick here. It's a nonfiction piece. It's an old episode of Radiolab from a while back called Rodney versus Death, you know, which is about rabies, and that's scary enough. But there's a bit around the 10-minute mark of that episode where they play archival recording of a rabies patient in the throes of madness. And it, you know, because it's a real medical condition, it's genuinely one of the scariest things that you can hear, I think.
All right, this is Nick Kwa. He's the host of the LAS Studios podcast about podcasts, Servant of Pod. Find out on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from Southern California voters today. Already, we've seen an overwhelming turnout this month, close to 2 million people in LA County alone. So we've been asking people why they vote. Here's Beth Smith, age 65.
My dad was in World War II as a soldier, and I have uncles who are also in World War II in the Pacific. And being able to vote and have a say in my government, even if it's just one vote, is really important to me. It's a responsibility as well as a right. It brings tears to my eyes to think about how important it is to vote.
That's voter Beth Smith. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take 2. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.